Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
To get over the consciousness transforming podcast for exceptional 21st century living. This show, folks, we're calling all astrology buffs. We're going to be speaking with Bruce Schofield, and we're talking about his latest book, The Nature of Astrology: History, Philosophy, and the Science of Self-Organizing Systems. Now, you guys, if you know anything about astrology, you've heard the name Bruce Schofield. Okay, so let's relax and learn from this wonderful man who is chock full of knowledge, who is going to enlighten us today regarding astrology. Now, the information shared on Get Over It uses intuitive and pragmatic insight to help you shift your consciousness to break through the blocks and release energy that is no longer needed. Yes, we're going to help you let go of the BS that's holding you back, but you guys know I always ask, are you truly ready to? And by the way, folks, BS is belief system. A bit about me for my new listeners, intuitive since birth. I'm a third generation intuitive with over 3 decades of experience supporting people to break through the blocks along their path. I'm a strategist for personal and professional transformation, revealing cutting edge information that enables you to prosper and thrive. I spent 25 successful years in corporate America as an executive sales professional, and I am the founder of Healing Visions Ministries and the Northern California Children's Education Network, a 501c3 nonprofit. I provide consultations and healings in all areas of life that heal the mind-body-spirit connection, allowing you to live your very best life. My clients tell me that I keep it real while providing them with accurate information to assist them along their journey as a spirit living a human existence. But they also say, if you really don't want to know, don't ask Monique. My background includes a doctorate in metaphysics, Reiki master teacher, ordained minister, and clinical hypnotherapist. So whether you are stressed, depressed, or possessed, I can help. To find out more about me and what I offer, go to my website, that's MoniqueChapman.com, and I invite you to like me on Facebook and follow me on LinkedIn. I'm no longer on Twitter, folks, so don't even look for me there. My guest today, Bruce Schofield, holds a doctorate in geosciences from the University of Massachusetts, a master's degree in social scientists from Montclair University, and a degree in history from Rutgers. A member of the National Council for Geocosmic Research and president of the Professional Astrologers Alliance, he's the author of 14 books, and he lives in Amherst, Massachusetts. And if you want to check out a website of his, you can go to onread.com. Actually, it's onread.com. So it'd be onreed.com. Again, onread.com. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, it's great to have you here. You know, you're such a veteran and so well known within the astrology community. I had a friend who was going to one of the meetings for the Professional Astrologers Alliance, Larry Martin, and he spoke very highly of you. And this is before I knew I'd ever have a chance to talk to you. So your Your reputation definitely does precede you. Go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, it's nice to hear.
Yeah. Okay, so your book, The Nature of Astrology, you talk scientifically in there, but it's not, you know, it's easy to digest. It's easy to read. What type of scientist do you consider yourself to be?
Well, I consider myself to be basically a methodological naturalist with a high tolerance for uncertainty and ambiguity. And what I mean by that is that there are a lot of different kinds of scientists. I mean, science is a set of methods. And one of the things I argue in the book is that we just can't call what's known as reductionist science all of science. Like, that's the only way to go about understanding nature. There are other ways because there are different kinds of nature. But maybe I should say more about that. I mean, reductionist science is the dominant form of science now. It came about during the 17th century, and Descartes and Newton and Galileo and people like that are associated with it. And what it does is, in order to learn about nature, it takes a piece of it out and puts it in a study situation like a laboratory, and then dissects it and, you know, tears it apart further and tries to figure out what it does and then fit it into some kind of mathematical model so that it's predictable. It sounds horrible, but it works really well. And, you know, the world has changed drastically in the last 300 years. I mean, we're getting robots now. I don't know about the flying planes, but lots of things are happening. We have pocket computers. It's unbelievable. And it's largely because of reductionist science, being able to, you know, really dig into the details. But along with that approach comes some negative things. And I think that the reductionist approach doesn't allow for a really big picture look at what's going on. And there's a tendency towards destroying things. I mean, I think it's reductionist science plays a major role in the desecration of the environment. And it also has a very close ally in the form of capitalism. So we have those two forces that they're not necessarily evil, but they can be used for negative, things. And they can be very destructive. So anyway, so what I'm trying to get at is that this is, in my view, a kind of science, but it's not all of science. And another kind of science that we probably are all familiar with would be observation. So you're a biologist and you go into the woods and you study the bears and the raccoons and the deer that are walking around and the squirrels, and you make notes and you observe their behavior and you try to understand what they're doing. That's doing science too, but it's not really taking apart nature. It's more observing it. Another kind of science, and the earliest form of science, is just being logical, you know, thinking clearly and not, you know, when you confront an issue that you can't figure out, and not saying, well, the gods did it, right? So that's science. The origins of science is really striving for an understanding that everyone can share. Science is democratic. It's, you know, if everyone can't see it, it's not really a finding. It's not knowledge produced by science. It may take a while for everybody. But anyway, my drift is that reductionism is a problem, and reductionism can't handle astrology. It also can't handle consciousness. It's having trouble with the origin of life. There are certain things that reductionist science has a great problem with, and what they are best described as are self-organizing systems with emergent properties. Now, that's a lot of words, but what astrology looks at, everything that astrology looks at, is some kind of self-organizing system. It's not a rock, or it's not a ball rolling down a ramp. You know, it's not a particle. It's a kind of living system. An example would be a body. You know, another example would be a cell. The brain, out of the brain emerges from its behaviors and its responses, emerges a personality, a mind and a personality. And astrology studies that. You get a lot of people together or a lot of other animals together, and they start behaving as a unit in themselves. You know, in the simplest form, you could talk about an ant colony, you know, or a beehive. You know, with humans, actually, the way they build condos these days, they do look like beehives to me.
But yes, they do.
So you have these groups of humans interacting together, and something emerges out of it. A good example would be the stock market. All these people are reacting, you know, second by second to things, and it's producing. The market is changing. It's evolving all the time. And reductionist science has a very difficult time reducing these systems because they live, they evolve. There are non-living systems. One would be weather, and another one would be climate, which is weather on a vast scale. Those are systems as well. In the Gaia hypothesis, as stated by James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis, the biosphere is a self-organizing system that's actually trying to optimize all the interactions between the earth and plants and animals and the atmosphere and the oceans in such a way that it produces an environment that's favorable for life. That's been a hard pill for a lot of reductionist scientists to swallow. But if you catch my drift here, I'm talking about a class of phenomena in nature that are generally called systems, more specifically self-organizing systems. And they have what are called emergent properties. Things come out of them that are not predictable. So this is the subject matter of astrology. That's one of the big points I try to make in my book. So it's a big picture. I'm taking a very big picture of many things, and particularly those things that are related to astrology. And getting back to your original question, when I do science, I'm basically following some rules. Like I did some science in terms of investigating weather patterns and possible relationships between weather patterns and planets, correlations. And I did my PhD thesis on that. I found a correlation between Saturn and Earth weather, which was completely unexpected by the people in my, you know, my group, the, you know, the advisory board there, committee. But it, the science was done right. So, you know, in that sense, I was doing science. But I see myself more as a naturalist. I'm looking at nature, and that means people too, because people are, we're part of nature, and trying to better understand them. And astrology is a great tool in understanding these self-organizing systems, which include humans, human personalities, collectives, and includes things like weather as well. Techniques are basically the same.
I'm really fascinated when you talk about the weather patterns and other planets. So what we're going through now all over this earth is a, I'm going to call it disruption for lack of a better word, in what we have become used to. And are there other planets out there that are going through this same type of disruption? Some people say it's ascension, some people say not. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that humans have disturbed the earth system. We've disturbed the weather and the climate terribly. And this is, you know, it's contested by a lot of people who really don't know much about it, but I studied this in graduate school and I follow it. We have disrupted the climate system. And so we will, what happens is that if you burn a lot of fossil fuels, that those gases accumulate and in the atmosphere, and they stay around for a long time, particularly carbon dioxide. But there are other ones like methane. And so in the equatorial regions, the sun is more dominant, right? You go to the equatorial regions, you know, and the sun is brighter. You get, you know, you get burned. It's just hotter. So more water evaporates in the equatorial regions, moves up into the air as water vapor. And water vapor is another greenhouse gas. It holds the heat in. So now that we've added to that with a little bit more carbon dioxide, the heat at the equatorial regions, particularly high up in the atmosphere, has increased. And now what we have is a steepened gradient between the heat of the equatorial regions and the cold of the polar regions. So say, let's say, for example, the normal situation, or the way the Earth has been for the last few, 2,000 or 3,000 years, say, the slope between the heat of the equator and the cold of the poles has been 30 degrees. Let's just call it that, like a slope, like a, you know, side of a hill. Well, we have ramped it up to about 45 degrees. So when you have a steeper gradient, you know, ball rolls faster, right? If you put a, you know, if you're, it's a steeper hill. So now the hot air of the equatorial regions is rushing to meet the cold air of the polar regions at a greater rate. And consequently, in the middle, which is where most people live, in the mid-latitudes, the weather is crazy. It's all disturbed. The gradient between hot and cold has been ramped up. The weather is trying to adjust to it. The air is trying to adjust to it. The temperature of the oceans and so on. And so we're going to have wilder and wilder weather unless we do something. And even then, it's not too late. But if we stopped all fossil fuel burning right now, it would probably take a couple hundred years for the Earth to readjust. And it may never go back to exactly the way it was, but at least we might prevent a total, you know, wipeout, you know, melt all the ice in the polar caps and the oceans go up 300 feet. That would not be fun.
No, because I would be underwater.
Yeah. But here's the thing. Astrology has long looked at weather as a system, and which is what I tested for my doctoral program. But and it still responds to these planetary aspects. Like as we speak today, Mars and Neptune are in square to each other, and the sun is there as well, and Mercury is right nearby. So we have a very tense alignment going up in the sky that is associated with storms that are storms of a liquid nature, not just a windstorm, you know, but more like a kind of a snow or rain or something like that event.
Okay. And
so this is in focus today. And we're seeing it in California, we're seeing it in New England, you know, the Northeast, it's happening. And under normal circumstances, that would have produced a storm. But in our time now, with a stronger gradient between hot and cold, and a disturbed middle latitude environment, it's worse. It's crazier. It's distorted. So the astrology still works, but it's working on a climate system and weather system that's been disturbed. So that's you can't separate those two things. You can't say, well, you know, the weather's responding to the planets. Well, sure it is, but it's responding to the greenhouse gases. It's called anthropogenic greenhouse gas forcing. That's the proper term for it, if anybody wants to know that. Anthropogenic, human-caused greenhouse gas, and then forcing, pushing it into the atmosphere. Great term.
Wow. I mean, you've just blown me away. One the average layperson doesn't necessarily think about astrology in those terms. When they hear the word astrology, they think maybe sun signs and transits and you know, retrogrades. But outside of that, there's not much of a correlation between the rest of the systems in our little galaxy here, in our little universe to talk about. So are you of the belief system that there is 9 planets in our system, more than 9? Where are you at regarding
that?
Well,
we have, obviously we have 8. Everything depends on definition, right? That's why Pluto, mm-hmm. Who enjoyed full planet status for a long time, got demoted to dwarf planet. And that's just a definition. And it's a definition that makes sense. A planet as defined now is an object that has basically cleared out its orbit and is big enough to pull itself into a sphere. Mm-hmm. Those are two of the definitions here. Pluto is a sphere, but it hasn't really cleared out its orbit. It's it cuts into Neptune's orbit, and it's very elliptical, and it's got other bodies near it. That doesn't mean it has no astrological influence. That's something else. But there's another planet, fairly large, that's been proposed based on orbital disturbances of other bodies that may be way out there. I mean, you go beyond Neptune and you run into the Kuiper Belt, which Pluto is an object in, and there's another body in there that's about the same size as Pluto called Eris. Have you ever heard of that?
I've heard of that, yes.
Eris, what a menace that thing is. That is, it's mischief. And when Uranus was transiting, Uranus is right now, it's in Taurus, but it went through Aries a few years ago. And Eris is it's way out there, and it goes very slow. So it's been in Aries for years, for decades. But when Uranus met Eris, we had almost to within a week or so, we had the Brexit event. And then we also had Trump getting elected.
Okay, that
was not lost on me. I was following this. I've been, when Eris was announced, I think the original name was Xena, but they mm-hmm. changed it. But Eris is interesting. Discord, troublemaker, that sort of thing. And I put it in the charts and I started watching it and seeing what it correlated with. But then when that Uranus went over it, I said, wow, yeah, this thing is trouble. Mm-hmm. So it's another point out there. So, and there are many others. There are a number of dwarf planets that astrologers experiment with. Eris is a good one, though, a pretty big one. And then you go beyond that, you have the Oort cloud way far away from the sun. And that's where a lot of comets hang out.
Hey, what's that called again?
The Oort cloud, Oort. Mm-hmm. And then you get towards the end of the solar system there. It's where it's called the heliopause, where this solar radiation kind of stops. And then you're off into deep space. Mm-hmm. So the solar system is a system. It's all these things are all hooked up and they're all moving with each other. And it's the larger system in which we humans and other organisms on our planet have evolved.
Okay.
And it's an environment. It's a kind of environment. And we think of our environment as, earth and trees and lakes and so on. But we have this cosmic environment, and then, that's kind of contained with the solar system. There's one obviously beyond that, but these planets are cycling all the time. They're moving around. And you look at the moon, it's moving around, changing phases. The Earth is orbiting the sun. The Earth is rotating. There are all these cosmic signals coming to us. And one of the things I talk about in my book is the idea that life evolved in two different kinds of environments. And one would be the spatial environment, which is, one organism is living in the water and another one on the land, and they're adapting to it and so on. But there's also a time environment, the temporal environment. Well, organisms are evolving in the alternation of day and night and the change of length of day relative to length of night over the course of a year, and the appearance and disappearances of Venus and the cycles of Saturn and Jupiter. All these things are time factors, creating like, I call it a temporal environment. And I think a lot of astrology may have been internalized millions of years ago. And life continued with that. We do know that the circadian rhythm, the 24-hour rhythm, evolved probably about 3 billion years ago in single-celled organisms, in bacteria. We know that. There's no question about it. So some of these other more subtle rhythms undoubtedly were picked up later. How a planet like Pluto or Eris, dwarf planets, very small bodies, very distant, how they affect us astrologically is unknown. I don't have an answer for that. I have some speculative answers, but we need to know more before we're going to really get all of astrology nailed down. But I think it's helpful to look at astrology as a subject, like psychology or medicine, for example, and it has a part of it that's dedicated to practice. And that's what most people think astrology is. They think it's only practice, but it's not. Astrology has history, it has theory, it has research, philosophy. These areas are not very well, they're not developed, really. There's some research, there's some very good research for astrology that exists, some theory, but most of the energy has gone into practice. And that's largely because of astrology's marginalized status. It's been persecuted by religion for many centuries.
It's interesting that you bring up religion, because it seems like religion has kind of gotten into the middle of everything that we use as history or we base our existence on. And it's not, in my opinion, necessarily the truth. What are your thoughts?
Well, one of the things I say in this book, my book, The Nature of Astrology, is that there are, just consider knowledge in general. And there are few kinds of knowledge that we use. And one is revealed knowledge. And you have a person has a vision or dreams and comes up with some ideas and then converts their, gets followers and gets them to adopt their point of view. And this is how a religion gets going. It's not really a democratic process. It's somebody's idea. And, it's the idea might be great and it may work perfectly for the moment, but it's a subjective assessment of reality. And then you have common sense. And common sense taken a little bit further would be know-how. Common sense is, you see this poison berry, you don't eat it because you figured it out. When other people ate it, they died. So, and know-how would be, the ability to build a house or to domesticate an animal or to build a computer. That's know-how. And you learn how to do it usually by trial and error. But then there's science, which is a more democratic way of making knowledge. And with science, what you do is experiments and you observe and you look at things very carefully. And then you make a statement and then you allow other people to test it as well. And when a consensus is reached, like voting, then you kind of include that as, well, okay, that's our next scientific fact. But it's always subject to revision. The thing about science is it's not a static process. It's a democratic way of building knowledge, of making knowledge. And that's very different from religion, which is somebody's subjective vision and everybody buys into it.
Yeah. People should be careful with what they buy into. To each his own, but it's important to be careful. I want to switch gears for a moment and talk about Kepler. Where does Kepler fit within the sciences that you're talking about? And what are your thoughts on Kepler's way of astrology?
Well, Kepler was one of the founders of modern astronomy and modern science. He was the first one to correctly mathematically model the solar system. He lived in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, roughly contemporary with Galileo and Francis Bacon. And he was really more of a mathematician. Mm-hmm. Back then, mathematicians were trying to solve a lot of the problems raised by astronomy and astrology. And he learned astrology early on, and part of his work was to create these almanacs every year, like a farmer's almanac type thing where there would be weather prediction. Mm-hmm. But he liked astrology. And also he was a consultant to some of the major figures of his time, General Wallenstein and the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Rudolf II, I believe. He always said that in regard to astrology, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. He was very, that's the subtitle of one of his books. He didn't like doing astrology readings because he thought a lot of the people that he had to deal with were full of themselves and wouldn't take his advice. And he thought that his work was wasted on them. Uh-huh. And he regretted or resented writing some of these almanacs because he said the people are so stupid, they don't know a good prediction from a bad one. So Kepler was critical of astrology in that sense, and a lot of that is often taken out of context by the self-appointed pit bulls of science that call themselves skeptics. Mm-hmm. and published. But Kepler liked astrology. A lot of his horoscopes have survived, his birth charts that he drew up. And I got the idea for my PhD thesis from one of his books. It's called Third Party Intervening. It's kind of a dialogue debate between a doctor, an astrologer, and Kepler. And one of the things he says in there is, if you want proof of astrology, just look at the aspects between the sun and Saturn and correlate them with weather. And he gave some examples. So that's exactly what I did. I said, okay, this guy said this in 1605, I guess, or 1610, something. Mm-hmm. I'll try it again. I'll try it in more detail. And I did. It took a few years and a lot of calculations, but I think I made a case for it. He was a good guy, I thought. He also wrote about his own personality. I don't think he liked himself very much. He was a Capricorn.
Oh, okay. interesting. I have Capricorn moon. Okay.
Very self-critical.
Extreme. It's truly amazing. Bruce, what is the future of astrology? What do you see?
Well, I think it's important. It will be important in the next 20, 30 years for astrology to become better organized. Right now, it's a cultural bubble. And people don't like to criticize each other, but fights over the, minor events break out periodically. Mm-hmm. It's all consultation. Everybody's got to compete and have their own little, theme or, their little niche in the system and in the, among other astrologers, and promotion becomes part of it. You can't go to the newspaper or you can't look for an ad that is searching for an astrologer. You have to do it yourself. So among consulting astrologers, there's a kind of selection process that goes on, and that the people who have better self-promotion instincts usually mm-hmm. better, but that doesn't mean they're better at doing astrology than somebody who doesn't like self-promotion.
Thank you for saying that, because everybody thinks that if you're number 1 through 5 on the search engine, when you put in a search term, those are the experts. No, they figured out how to do this search engine optimization. Doesn't mean that they're the best in the world. Thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate that. aspect. Question for you, though. When we go to your website, onereed.com, and that's O-N-E-R-E-E-D.com, what are we going to find there?
Well, in the 80s and 90s, I spent a lot of time studying ancient Mesoamerica. I wanted to learn about Maya astrology, Aztec astrology, and I studied it extensively and wrote a few books on it. So somewhere around the late 90s or so, my friend Barry and I decided, he was also interested in it as well, to put up a web page. And One Read is the English translation of Seyacatl, which is the Aztec word for Quetzalcoatl, the god Quetzalcoatl from ancient Mexico. Mm-hmm. So that's what that's all about. So you'll find a lot of information on Mesoamerican astrology and some links to talks that I've given and some articles that I've written. It's a mixed bag. I don't have that hustler instinct in me. I have Mars in Libra. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but you know, Mars is the kind of pushy planet, and you put it mm-hmm. in Libra and all it wants to do is compromise. Mm-hmm. So you don't usually see that in the charts of captains of industry or, you know, successful promoters and so on. So I haven't really done that much with it. Maybe we will later. But you can find some information. There are links. And I think you, if anybody's interested in Mesoamerican astrology, they'll certainly find some, they'll find it interesting.
Okay. Have you ever done a chart on America per se, and to kind of chart where we're going as a nation?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's quite a bit of debate about what chart works best for the United States. And I tend to go along with the afternoon of July 4th, which is when the Committee of Five finished writing up the Declaration. It had been passed earlier in the day in a vote. And the Committee of Five did some editing on it. And Jefferson and Franklin were a part of all of that. And then they took it down to the printer and they gave it to the printer. And mm-hmm. as best I can figure out, that was about 5 o'clock. So in my view, that was the point of no return. Because the next day, the printer printed it overnight, and the next day they were passing this around. So what's the key moment? When they voted on it? I don't think so. I think because they were still editing it, they were changing some wording until mm-hmm. the very end. Anyway, so that chart has Sun and Cancer and Sagittarius rising and Aquarius moon. And the United States chart shows a lot of pressure these days. We're having our Pluto return. And I think if we were living 100 or 150 years earlier, it would have been a real mess. But we're doing okay, more or less. I mean, we had the COVID experience and lockdown, and we have all sorts of political problems.
I was going to say we had the Trump experience.
Yeah, we had that. And, you know, there's a war going on with Russia. We're in it indirectly. So there's a lot going on. I think the financial world is still pretty unstable. And we're not through this yet. I mean, we're walking through a very difficult passage in U.S. history. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to use what I was saying earlier as a reference, under normal circumstances, a certain kind of planetary aspect, like say Mars square Neptune, will correlate with a disruption of the atmosphere, and you'll get a storm of some sort. But when the weather system is so disturbed as it is now due to fossil fuels, the same aspect just gets amplified, and it's worse. So in a kind of reverse way, we're more sophisticated and civilized now than we were 200 years ago. So, as I was suggesting before, if the aspects that the US chart is under now had happened 200 years ago, it would have been a big mess. But we're, you know, I think there are some cool heads that are keeping the thing going. So I'm not terribly pessimistic. I'm a little pessimistic because there are some forces that are really trying to wreck the system right now.
Mm-hmm. And they seem to be gaining a foothold in it.
Well, they know how to work the media. That's probably part of it. You know, so we hear more about it than what's really happening. But it is happening. So I think that there will be continuing problems for the next few years, complex problems, but I don't think that they'll be quite as devastating as they would have been had this happened decades and decades ago when people were crazier. Okay. On the other hand, it would not surprise me if somewhere in the early 2030s, parts of this country break up. Probably, 2033, 2034. That's a prediction I made a while back. I should revisit it. Mm-hmm. Look at my thinking. But it wouldn't surprise me if, a chunk of the country said, the heck with this, we're going on our own.
Interesting. It brings us down to a divide when I hear you say that, the red states, the blue states. So is that the type of thing that you're?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, it would seem that the Northeast and the West, the Pacific states, mm-hmm. they're operating on a different wavelength than a lot of these other ones are. But yeah. We'll see. It's you can't make an exact prediction. But what I base this on is the fact that there's this continuing tension, territorial tension, that I don't think that goes away so quickly. And it may flare up at times, and maybe some different definition of statehood will come about.
Okay. Do you foresee for the next political election, the presidential election, an energy that is more like Biden or an energy more like Trump and DeSantis?
Well, to be honest with you, I haven't looked at it. What I've been paying attention to lately is that Saturn has gone into Pisces. It has left Aquarius, although it'll, it's been in there. It was in there for 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And it's gone into Pisces. And I've been watching that very carefully. That happened a few weeks ago. And Saturn in Pisces, Saturn is reality. It's law, it's structure. And it's gone into Pisces, which is chaos and expanse and the oceans and belief systems. So my forecast for this originally was that this would be a time when a lot of the nonsense that poses as truth will get caught, will get nailed, and the laws will be made. What surprised me, what didn't surprise me in a way, is that within a day or two of Saturn going into Pisces, the International Committee got together and passed some laws protecting the oceans. Now think about that. Saturn goes into Pisces, and now the whole world's together protecting the oceans. And to me, that's visionary. I mean, it may not be all that you'd really want. You'd want more if you were an environmentalist than I would. But it's something, and it's very significant. And at the same time, this business with Fox News Entertainment, came out, and we're beginning to see how corrupt that whole thing is, and what nonsense that is. I've long said that if you want to change this country, you have to take out Fox News and its imitators, because they're. It's a capitalist scheme. They're just making money out of playing with people's minds. And that's serious. People should be arrested for that. But because we have freedom of speech, it's not easy to get at. You can't take it down that easily.
I agree 10,000%, but what happened to critical thinking for the average person?
There's a war against critical thinking by a lot of people on the right side of the political spectrum, and they don't like evolution and they don't like climate change. They think they know more about virology than medical experts. So there's a thing going on there. It's unfortunate. I step back a few paces, and one of the things I think about is the idea that we have so many people on our planet now. And there's a crowding in a sense. I mean, granted, there are plenty of open areas, but you really can't live in them. But people are jammed together and the behaviors are getting crazier. And there's a bit of a panic setting in. And when a panic sets in, critical thinking is thrown overboard. So that's kind of one of the ways I think about it, that this is a result of crowding, of overcrowding. When you get too many people, you need crowd control. And crowd mm-hmm. control is pretty much only possible in an authoritarian system, immediate crowd control. Mm-hmm. Be able to, turn on a dime and do it like they can in Russia or China or Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And we're a democracy. Everything happens slow, takes a long time. And we have a constitution that says, hey, people can say whatever they want. But our civilization is, 100 times more complex than it was in 1787 when the Constitution was put together.
Yeah, you think, but a lot of people want to go back to that strict interpretation that doesn't fit today's world.
Yeah, because they're afraid.
Mm-hmm.
People are scared. They don't know why. And it's being played on. The fears are being played on by certain news outlets. And it's unfortunate. I'm somewhat pessimistic in some ways, in many ways, actually. But I have some optimism, too. As I said before, in general, we know more now. There just has to be enough of us that know more, that get involved and try to push the civilization in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
What did I read this morning? We're at a crossroads between going into Star Trek or going into The Handmaid's Tale.
That's interesting. Wow. On that, Bruce, I've enjoyed speaking with you so much. Your time is truly up, but what pearl of wisdom would you like to leave with the audience today?
Well, think about not being too anthropocentric. How's that? I think anthropocentrism, which means basically all you think about is people, everything in terms of people, it creates a lot of problems. We have to examine these ideas that we've taken for granted, that people are some kind of are very, very special, exceptional species on our planet. Oh yeah, we're really clever. I'm not going to dispute that.
Uh-huh.
But I think that if we can get out of this obsession with people everywhere and look at nature as a whole and think about how the diversity of species is what actually creates strength and resilience in an ecosystem or a giant ecosystem that we call Gaia, the whole biosphere and its interactions. I just think that's something people should practice.
Yeah. I mean, it gets us out of the me aspect of living.
Yeah.
And we think about others and other substances like the grass and the plants and, the trees.
And the bacteria on which we're dependent. Mm. And if it wasn't for the bacteria, we wouldn't be here.
Okay. I know I said I'm out of time, but I want to hear a little bit more about that. Bacteria and we wouldn't be here?
Yeah, well, the bacteria make a lot of the oxygen that we breathe, about half of it probably. And they keep our digestive tracts, going. They modulate all these chemical reactions and produce substances that we need. The bacteria were here first, and we owe a lot to them. So, if you can step away from being anthropocentric, and as you pointed out, it's just like saying that, if you're obsessed with yourself on a personal psychological level, that's not good. You got to see it from other people's points of view. I'm taking this to the next level and saying that, as a species, we should be less obsessed with ourselves and look at what's going on around us and learn from it.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And Bruce, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and attention. Folks, The Nature of Astrology. If you enjoyed the conversation today, get the book. It goes much, much deeper. And it will allow you to open up those brain cells and think outside the box, because that's what's needed at this time in our evolution. At least that's what I feel. So Bruce, thank you. Audience, thank you. I always appreciate you very, very much. And everyone, please remember that the most important choice that you can make is what you choose to make important. Consider making the masterful choice of discovering the nature of astrology. Abundant blessings, light and love to all. Agape.